Today on this deep dive, we're looking at a June 2026 analysis by HKDH Padatia. And this analysis takes a look at some groundbreaking experimental observations that were recently published by Light et al. In the Journal of Materials Research and Technology.
Yes, that's volume 43.
Right, volume 43, page 2925 for anyone keeping track.
And, you know, the focus of the Light et al. Paper is actually incredibly specific, which is exactly why it's able to solve such a broad mystery.
Okay, how so?
Well, they're exploring how silicon affects phase transformation kinetics and austenite stabilization. Specifically, the researchers are looking at high silicon steel under what they term twin roll strip casting relevant cooling.
It is a mouthful.
It is. Along with simulated coiling conditions. Basically, they are isolating a very specific set of conditions to just watch the metal structure build itself in real time.
Okay, so let's talk about the exact material being tested here before we jump into the results.
Yeah, that's
iron, 0.25 weight percent carbon, 2% silicon, 2% manganese, and 0.25% chromium.
Spot on.
Now, in the past, people might have compared this to like a highly sensitive baking recipe, right? Where tweaking one ingredient completely changes the cake.
I mean, it's a common analogy.
Yeah, but that really doesn't capture the actual physics of what's happening here, does it? Like, adding 2% silicon isn't just changing the flavor of the steel.
Oh, not at all. No, that 2% silicon acts much more like a microscopic roadblock.
A roadblock.
Yeah. In traditional steels, when you cool the metal down and it undergoes a phase transformation to form bainite, the carbon tends to precipitate out and form cementite.
Which are essentially iron carbides.
Exactly, iron carbides. But when you introduce that specific 2% silicon concentration, it intentionally suppresses that carbide formation. The silicon physically prevents the cementite from forming during the bainitic reaction.
Oh, wow. So by throwing up that silicon roadblock, the carbon basically has nowhere to go.
Right.
At least in terms of forming carbides.
Right.
Which means it just gets trapped in the remaining untransformed part of the metal, the retained austenite.
That is the crucial mechanism right there. By stabilizing the austenite and keeping the carbon in a solid solution rather than, you know, losing it to carbides lie at all, created a scenario where they could actually measure the isolated carbon concentration.
Which sounds impossible.
It's very difficult to measure something that infinitesimally small, hiding inside a bainitic microstructure. You need a highly specialized tool. So they utilized high resolution X-ray diffraction.
Okay, which allows them to get incredibly precise measurements of those carbon concentrations without actually having to physically tear the retained austenite apart.
Right, it's non-destructive.
You just bounce X-rays through the crystal lattice, and based on how those rays diffract, you can calculate the exact concentration of carbon sitting interstitially between the iron atoms. You're mapping the architecture of the metal as it transforms.
Exactly, and this matters because if you want to understand how durable or, you know, flexible this high silicon steel will be in real industrial applications, you just can't rely on theoretical estimates of where the carbon ends up.
Because the carbon dictates the strength.
Precisely. Carbon dictates the strength of the final material. You need physical proof of where the carbon is hiding and in what exact quantities. The high resolution X-ray diffraction finally provided that undeniable physical proof.
So I want to look really closely at the data they extracted using that X-ray diffraction, because when you lay out the numbers, a highly rigid pattern starts to emerge.
It's a very striking pattern.
Yeah. They extracted a quantitative data set covering the isothermal transformation temperatures and the corresponding carbon concentrations in the austenite. So let's look at the range from 280 to 310 degrees Celsius. At 280 degrees, the carbon concentration sits at 1.25 weight percent, which is a 0.0545 mole fraction.
And then they increase the isothermal transformation temperature by 10 degrees.
Okay.
So at 290 degrees Celsius, the carbon drops down to 1.1 Ohnian weight percent, or a 0.0516 mole fraction.
Got it. And then we bump the heat another 10 degrees to 300 degrees Celsius, and the carbon drops again to 1.04 weight percent, which is a 0.0457 mole fraction.
Yep.
And finally, at 310 degrees Celsius, it falls to 0.89 weight percent, a 0.0393 mole fraction.
Exactly.
I'm looking at this mathematical descent, and I just have to point out the changing deltas here.
Right, the rate of change.
Yeah, because from 280 to 290, it drops 0.07%. But from 290 to 300, it drops 0.14%. And then 0.15% for the next 10 degrees. As the temperature goes up, the amount of carbon trapped in the austenite doesn't just go down. The rate of that rejection seems to shift.
It does.
Why is this data so rigidly structured? Because, I mean, in metallurgy, thermal dynamics are usually incredibly messy.
Right.
But this looks like it's obeying a very strict, unforgiving physical law rather than just, you know, random thermal cooling.
You've hit the nail on the head. The rigidity of that trend is exactly what caught the researchers' attention. It isn't just a general observation that, like, hotter temperatures mean less trapped carbon. The true beauty of this data set is its strict mathematical precision. Like, et al. Didn't just plot points. They established rigorous lower and upper experimental error bounds for every single point.
Oh, so there's no wiggle room.
Barely any. At 280 degrees Celsius, the bounds are explicitly defined as 1.18 on the low end to 1.32 weight percent on the high end. This isn't observational guesswork. It's a highly precise ruler that they can now use to measure against the established laws of thermodynamics.
Okay, and that introduces the massive thermodynamic tug of war that Padacia analyzes in the text.
Yes, the core of the debate.
We have these precise real-world numbers from the X-rays, but to figure out the actual mechanism of how the bainite is forming, we have to feed those numbers into two competing thermodynamic theories that scientists have debated for years.
Right, the TO limit and the perequilibrium A3 curve.
Exactly. Let's define the A3 curve first.
Okay, so think of the perequilibrium A3 curve as the, well, the lazy river scenario for phase transformation.
The lazy river, I like that.
Yeah, it's the theoretical boundary where carbon has all the time in the world to just casually migrate or diffuse and reach a state of equilibrium between the newly growing ferret and the parent austenite.
So it's a slower process.
Right. It assumes a reconstructive mechanism where the atoms have the thermal energy and the time to just, you know, break bonds, move around, and rearrange themselves leisurely into their preferred energy states.
So under the AE3 curve theory, the carbon is actively shuffling around while the new crystal structure is being built.
Exactly.
But the TAO limit describes a completely different reality. The source defines the T0 curve as the boundary where the free energy of austenite and ferrite of identical composition are equal.
Which is a very dense way of putting it.
Yeah, I want to unpack that phrase because it is dense.
Yeah.
We're talking about a diffusionless mechanism here.
Yeah.
I view it like a flash freeze.
A flash freeze, yes.
If you flash freeze water, it turns to ice instantly, trapping whatever is inside it right in place. In this diffusionless model, the structure snaps from austenite into bainitic ferrite so incredibly fast that the carbon just doesn't have the luxury of that lazy river.
Right, there's no time to diffuse.
It cannot diffuse. The new phase is forced to inherit the exact same chemical composition as the parent austenite it just transformed from.
Exactly. And if the bainite transformation operates on that flash freeze mechanism, then it is strictly bound by the laws of free energy. It has to hit a hard thermodynamic wall.
Okay.
The reaction must completely cease the absolute millisecond the carbon concentration in the remaining austenite hits that T0 condition limit.
Because it just runs out of energy.
Essentially, yes. The T0 curve represents the absolute maximum carbon concentration you can pack into the austenite before the free energy balance breaks. Once you cross that line, a diffusionless transformation physically cannot continue.
Wow.
Yeah, because the thermodynamics just won't allow the newly forming ferrite to hold any more carbon than the austenite it's growing from.
Right, I'm genuinely confused here.
Okay, what's tripping you up?
If this is truly a flash freeze, where the new bainitic ferrite inherits the exact same carbon levels as the parent austenite, shouldn't the carbon just be trapped in the newly formed ferrite forever?
Ah.
Like, how does it end up pooling in the residual austenite for the X-rays to measure it? If the metal snaps into a new phase instantly and diffusion is impossible, where is the window for the carbon to actually migrate and create these concentrations we see in the data?
That is the exact paradox that has driven this decades-long debate.
Okay, glad I'm not the only one.
No, it's a huge question. The answer lies in separating the growth of the bainite plate from what happens immediately after it grows.
After it grows?
Yeah. The physical growth of the new structure is the instant flash freeze. It snaps into place without diffusion. However, immediately following that sub-second growth, you have a newly formed plate of supersaturated ferrite, which absolutely hates holding that much carbon.
Oh, I see.
So the moment the diffusionless growth halts, which, remember, happens right when it hits the T0 limit, the excess carbon is expelled. It partitions out of the newly formed ferrite and migrates into the surrounding residual austenite.
Ah, okay. So we aren't looking at a single blended event where the metal slowly morphs and the carbon casually swims around.
No, not at all.
We are looking at a highly choreographed, discrete two-step sequence.
Exactly.
Step one, the sudden diffusionless flash freeze growth that builds the new structure right up to the T0 limit.
Yep.
Step two, post-growth, The carbon is forcefully evicted and partitions into the remaining austenite.
That is the proposed sequence. But, you know, proposing it is one thing, actually proving it is another.
Right.
And this is where the paper really reaches its climax. Like,
yeah.
et al. Took their highly precise X-ray diffraction data, the exact measurements of carbon sitting in the retained austenite at this specific temperature, and they overlaid those data points onto figure one of their study.
The ultimate test.
Yeah. They mapped them directly against the calculated theoretical curves for both the T0 limit and the AE3 curve.
And the results were definitive. The experimental data shows what the analysis calls an outstanding agreement with the calculated T0 limit.
It's almost a perfect match.
The real-world measurements landed practically on top of the flash freeze boundary. And at the same time, the data points are nowhere near the periequilibrium AE3 curve.
Right.
They completely diverge from the lazy river theory.
Completely. And because the experimental data perfectly tracks the T0 condition and wildly ignores the AE3 line, it provides compelling, undeniable evidence for the mechanism.
It physically proves it.
Yes. It proves that the transformation to bainite in this high silicon steel is diffusionless. The growth happens without carbon movement, strictly governed by the free energy limitations of the T0 curve, and the carbon partitioning happens entirely as a secondary, subsequent process.
I mean, proving a sequence like this requires an insane level of theoretical calculation to match against the real-world data.
Oh, absolutely.
How did the authors calculate the exact shape of that T0 curve for this highly specific five-element alloy? You don't just, like, calculate multi-component free energy surfaces on a whim.
No, the thermodynamic modeling required for this is immense. The calculations presented in the analysis were executed using the MUCG46 software package.
Okay.
But what is really fascinating about this specific software is its legacy. It was originally archived by HKDH Padeshia, the author of the analysis we're discussing, back in 1982.
1982.
Yes. We are looking at a thermodynamic model that was built over 40 years ago.
That's wild. And now, in 2026, we finally have the high-resolution X-ray diffraction technology required to physically observe the nanoscale carbon concentrations and definitively prove that the 1982 algorithm was exactly right about where that thermodynamic wall exists.
Yeah. The theoretical math essentially waited four decades for the physical tools to catch up.
That is incredible.
It is. And what's brilliant for the scientific community today is that MUCG46 is no longer just archived code. It's freely available for researchers globally via an interactive online portal. It's the MUCG TTT calculator.
Oh, very cool.
So anyone studying advanced metallurgy can input their own complex alloy compositions and accurately model these free energy limits.
And for anyone listening who wants to push deeper into the absolute bedrock of this science, there's a comprehensive 2026 critical assessment published in Metallurgical and Materials Transactions A.
Highly recommend that one.
Yeah, it's volume 57, spanning pages 1 to 20, and the title just perfectly encapsulates the magnitude of this research. It's called Mechanism of the Bainite Transformation, a Turning Point.
It truly is a turning point for material science, fundamentally resolving the mechanism. But, you know, we need to connect this back to why this specific microscopic two-step dance matters on an industrial scale.
Right, the real-world application.
Earlier we mentioned twin roll strip casting. This is a massive manufacturing process where molten steel is rapidly cooled between two counter-rotating rollers to produce thin sheets of steel directly from the liquid phase. It's highly efficient, but it requires incredibly precise control over the cooling rates.
Because if you don't know the exact mechanism of how the internal structure of the steel is forming as it rolls through those cooling machines, you are essentially flying blind.
Exactly.
You're just tweaking dials and hoping the final sheet of metal has the right flexibility and tensile strength.
But now engineers have the map. Because this research proves that bainite grows without diffusion first and carbon partition second, and because they know exactly where that T0 limit wall is for this specific high silicon recipe, engineers can mathematically tune their twin roll strip casting and simulated coiling processes.
They can dial in the exact speed of the rollers and the precise temperature drops.
Yes.
Because they know exactly how many milliseconds the carbon needs in step two to partition and stabilize the austenite before the metal cools down further into something brittle, like martensite.
Right. They aren't guessing how the alloy will behave anymore. They are manipulating the thermodynamic laws they now have absolute proof of.
It shifts high silicon and steel manufacturing from just an observational practice into a domain of total mathematical certainty.
It really does. When you know the unyielding thermodynamic rules governing the phase transformation, you can engineer the microstructure of the metal atom by atom.
Wow.
You ensure the retained austenite provides the exact mechanical properties you need for, say, automotive parts or structural engineering.
It takes the blindfold off the entire manufacturing industry for these advanced alloys.
It really does.
And that leaves me with a final thought I want you to mull over today. Steel is the material humanity has actively forged, studied, and utilized for literally centuries. Our entire modern world is built on it.
Yeah.
Yet a mechanism as foundational as the bainite transformation, how the carbon actually moves and settles to give the metal its strength, is only just now reaching a definitive turning point in 2026.
It's humbling, really.
It is. It took the perfect combination of a high silicon roadblock, high resolution X-ray diffraction, and a 4-decade-old thermodynamic algorithm to finally crack the code. It makes you wonder, what other settled scientific mechanisms in the everyday material surrounding you right now are secretly operating on completely counterintuitive multi-step rules, just waiting for someone to invent the right tool to finally uncover them?